It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. About 13,000 disabled workers in Pennsylvania are earning an average of $2.40 an hour in illegal use of subminimum wages. They're given menial tasks, and since 1986, there has been no limit to how little they can be paid. The question is whether this practice provides opportunities for people who wouldn't otherwise have a job or exploits those who could work for minimum wage if given the chance. I'm joined now in Studio A by reporter Hallie Stockton, who has covered this story for our content partner, Public Source. Hallie Stockton, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me again.
And also with us by phone is, from Philadelphia, is Charlotte Swenson, whose daughter Teresa has Down syndrome and works at Bucks County Nonprofit Associated Production Services, which employs the most people with disabilities at subminimum wages in the state. Charlotte Swenson, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
We are also scheduled to be joined from Washington by Curtis Decker. He is the executive director of the National Disability Rights Network, the nation's largest non-governmental enforcer of disability rights. And we hope to have him with us later during the course of this conversation. But Hallie Stockton, let's start with what got you onto this story of disabled workers being employed at subminimum wages. What did Public Source do to report this story?
Sure. It was something that I came across when I was writing a story about a local couple who both have cerebral palsy, and the wife went to work. And I got to go with her to work and talk to her about what she did. And she would go for full, 6 to 8 hours every day, and she would be packing mail inserts. And it was mostly along other people with disabilities. And it was new to me. It was something I had not yet seen in the course of my reporting on issues facing people with disabilities. So I talked to her more about that opportunity, about how long she's been there. She's been there for 20 years, and she was earning $8.11 an hour. And I thought, wow, 20 years. And that's her pay per hour. And she talked to me about how when she started 20 years ago, she started with an hourly wage of about $1.83. And I hadn't known about that was possible to be paid a subminimum wage. And so really, we got started on this kind of on a quest to learn about how it is legal and why it's there. So what we did was we learned about the program, and this was something that was established in 1938 under the Fair Labor Standards Act.
So this goes all the way back to the Depression.
Absolutely, yes.
And this was not necessarily established for disabled workers, or was it?
There are other classes that that can be included. At that time, it was also for veterans coming back from war, and but it was mostly to encourage employers throughout the country to employ people with disabilities.
A way of stimulating the economy, which is also interesting because it wasn't until just earlier in that decade that the minimum wage even existed. I think FDR created it early in his administration, and then years later they had to make that exception for people.
Right.
So there is, I mentioned at the outset that since 1986, there's been no limit to how little people can be paid. What happened there? What is the history of that?
Congress decided to do this, and some of the advocates will be able to explain it a little bit better, but there was actually another change going on, and that eliminating the wage floor was just kind of slipped in and wasn't something that really caught the eyes or ears of the people who serve the disabled community.
And the jobs that they're given, describe, I called them menial jobs. What exactly are they? Are people that are employed by these companies within this program? What are they? What tasks are they given?
They're by design kind of low skill jobs that can be tackled in a step by step, so that supervisors can train. This is the envelope, and we want you to put this insert into each envelope, and then put the envelope in a box, or we want you to assemble a jewelry box or kits of nuts and bolts.
And the conditions they're working under, how would you describe those?
I think it's going to be different at every place. I believe, from reaction from people, there are several beautiful campuses where a work program is part of this. There are also some that are kind of set up in a factory-like setting.
Are there people that are in some of these situations, is it disabled workers strictly working with other disabled workers, or are there cases where the disabled workers are working with other people that are employed by the company?
The majority of what we found are people with disabilities working with other people with disabilities, and you'll have a few non-disabled supervisors on the floor as well.
And what kind of oversight is there? How do they supervise them?
They will help kind of in completing the task. If somebody is having trouble with something or isn't feeling well, they'll do a little bit more of if there's something more elevated that needs to be done, and they record too. This is all piecework, so you get paid for every box of paper you shred. You get paid 20 cents or, you know, every jewelry box, 11 cents. And so those supervisors are watching and recording that, you know, this person completed 3 this hour, completed 4. And then that's what translates into your paycheck.
And so you've gone into these places and how would you describe the environment? Or do the people working there seem to be getting something out of this?
I think so. And really, this is a very divisive issue. And
you've reported that the federal program is under attack at the state and national level.
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of legislation addressing this at the federal level. And then statewide, there are a lot of really important conversations going on to decide whether these work centers, often called sheltered workshops, are the, you know, how people with disabilities should be spending their days.
Let's bring in our other guests, starting with Curtis Decker, Executive Director of the National Disability Rights Network. Mr. Decker, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Joining us by phone from Washington. Why do you oppose this program that allows disabled people to be employed at sub-minimum wages?
Well, I think opposition is the wrong word. What we're trying to do is have people realize that this is an outmoded way of doing business, something that was created in the 30s, well-intentioned, but now we have gotten stuck in a rut where even though it was intended that people would be trained so they could move into integrated and competitive employment, what we have found, and as you've just heard, it has meant that that people just stay there, sometimes for 20 or 30 years, because the business model is to keep people there, not necessarily get them out of the workshop. And so we really want to challenge these providers to embrace these new concepts of supported employment, customized employment. So, for example, what happens in a shelter workshop, whatever the contract is, that's the kind of work you get to do, whether you're capable of doing it or not, and so then you're assessed as not being productive. We are trying to look at people and find out what their talents are, what they can do, and then put them in jobs that they really can excel in. And there's been a lot of that around the country, and now we're trying to push some of these providers to start thinking differently.
So if I understand you correctly, the issue that that the National Disability Rights Network has with these programs is that someone is brought in and they're asked to conform to a system that's already been in place and been in place for a long, long time. And if they do not excel based on the way things are set up, there's no adjustment to what this person is bringing to the job. They are simply stuck in a position where they can't move up and can't increase their pay.
That's right. For example, if the sheltered workshop has a shredding contract or a laundry contract, that's what you do, and you don't get any choice. It's not like you're applying for that job. That's what they have for you to do. And if you can't do that, if you don't have, you have dexterity problems, or you can't, or sometimes your thought process doesn't work in the way happens, then you're assessed by the provider, the very people who get to pay you. They say, oh, you were only 20% productive or 10%, and so we can pay you, under the law, a dollar or 50 cents. And, of course, as we were speaking before, when you ask about, many of the people are very happy there, But I would argue they don't have any other alternative. They've never been exposed to anything else. So, of course, you're used to what your environment, and they do have my favorite story is when we talk to people and they say, yes, I like it here. I have friends here. It's very pleasant, but I like my other job better. And then we say, what is that? He said, well, I work on the weekend for minimum wage bagging groceries at a supermarket. And then he comes into the Sheltered Workshop and they say, you're not productive. We can pay you 10 cents, $20, $1, $2 an hour. So we need to expose people gradually, show them what the alternatives are. We need to provide training and make sure that there's jobs that fit the person's capability. And, I mean, the other thing that we're concerned about is the fact that we find that very little people in the Sheltered Workshops have access to assistive technology. One of the great benefits to people with disabilities in the last 20 years has been the explosion of all kinds of assistive technology that make them more productive, help them integrate into society. And we find that in the Sheltered Workshops, hardly any of those devices or products are available, which could make them more productive.
And Curtis Decker, your point's well taken. However, certainly there are some parents and family members of people, of some of these disabled workers, who might disagree with you, and one of them possibly being Charlotte Swenson, who joins us now by phone from Philadelphia. Ms. Swenson, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Your daughter, Teresa, has Down syndrome, and she works at the Bucks County Nonprofit Associated Production Services. It employs the most people with disabilities at subminimum wages in the state. How do you feel about your daughter working at a place where she is paid less than minimum wage?
I am not interested, really, in the money. I'm interested in a program for her. I think there are some people who are at sheltered workshops who could work in competitive employment, depending on the job available. But in my daughter's case, it hasn't just been one job. She has really been encouraged to do many different things, some things she likes better than others, and they have often tried to keep her at a job that she prefers. She is just naturally slower. She's very, very good at labeling because she is very careful. On the other hand, she's older now and she's slowed down a lot. I think there are room for both answers, both the sheltered workshop for some. My daughter, for instance, I would have a concern for her safety. She doesn't have a good concept of traffic. A car may be stopped or coming. That wouldn't really matter to her. That has always been one of my main concerns, is her safety. Socially, she receives a lot of benefits that in competitive employment she might not receive because of her intellectual disability. There may not be that many people who would be interested in socializing with her. I must say to you, we also receive door-to-door transportation. When you get into competitive employment, that is not always available. In fact, most of the time it isn't, unless there is paratransit available. So there are a lot of problems facing families that vary so much.
So you
and I, to me, it would seem that there is room and a need for both answers.
But what you're saying is if there was a strict adherence to a law that limited any of these opportunities to or made it a stipulation that anybody who was involved in one of these programs had to be paid minimum wage, it sounds like you're concerned that if that were the case, your daughter would not have the opportunities that she has now.
I would think that the workshops receive money, of course, from the contracts that they get. And they're also paid a per diem per person, and that varies from the county, which also comes through the state monies. That varies depending on each workshop. They have, you know, like any business, a lot of expenses. My fear would be paying minimum wage to everyone who does not, cannot perform at a level with piecework to verify that minimum wage might put a lot of these clients at these workshops in jeopardy as far as working goes, if this became a requirement.
We're talking about programs for disabled workers in Pennsylvania that pay them sub-minimum wages under a setup that makes it entirely legal, but that some feel is unfair and outdated. Our guests are the woman who brought this story to light for our content partner, Public Source, reporter Hallie Stockton. Also with us by phone from Washington is Curtis Decker, executive director of the National Disability Rights Network, and Charlotte Swenson, whose daughter, Teresa, works at Bucks County Nonprofit Associated Production Services, which employs the most people with disabilities at subminimum wages in the state. We'd like to get your input before we take a break here. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. The email address, ESSPGH@WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EP Live. Join the conversation. Do you feel that the system setting up legal use of subminimum wages to be paid to disabled workers is fair or not? How can it be revised or altered? 412-246-2002, the number to call. We'll take a break and continue the conversation. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This is Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking about 13,000 disabled workers in Pennsylvania earning an average of $2.40 an hour in legal use of subminimum wages. The issue of subminimum wages for disabled workers is a controversial one, and the question is whether this practice provides opportunities for people who wouldn't otherwise have a job or exploits those who could work for minimum wage if given the chance. We'd like to hear from you at 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EP Live. I'm joined in Studio A by reporter Hallie Stockton, who's covered this story for our content partner, Public Source. Also with us by phone from Washington is Curtis Decker, executive director of the National Disability Rights Network. And from Philadelphia, Charlotte Swenson, whose daughter Teresa has Down syndrome and works at Bucks County Nonprofit Associated Production Services, which pays subminimum wages to people with disabilities. And Ms. Swenson, we appreciate your time. But before we let you go, is there anything else that you feel it's important for people to know about the experience that your daughter has had and why you feel that it's made a difference in her life?
I think it has given her a feeling of self-worth. She has a place to go every day that's a job. I find that my friends whose children are in competitive employment and being paid whatever the going rate is may only be working 4 hours a day, 3 days a week. She has some place to go every day. On top of that, we're also receiving transportation, getting there and getting back. So there is a safety factor that, in my case, I'm relieved to have. On top of that, through the years, people with disabilities, at least from what I know of the intellectually disabled, have been receiving help all along and still are eligible for it, either with SSI or through Social Security if they are old enough and their parents are old enough that they're on Medicare. So they're receiving a lot of help along the way. So now, don't misunderstand me. If a person is able and willing and can manage working in competitive employment, I think that's wonderful. But I think there is a need for the sheltered workshop, not only for those with mental, intellectual disabilities, but they also serve a place for those people who not only have intellectual disabilities, but also mental health problems, which can pose problems out in the competitive employment world. So I think there is a need for both efforts, but I would not like to see one take place of another. One shoe size does not fit everyone, and neither does one position in providing a place for them to work.
Charlotte Swenson, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And so, Curtis, and we can now welcome in calls at 412-246-2002 to get some opinions from others. And if there are other parents or family members of disabled workers out there who want to weigh in on this, certainly we want to hear from you at 412-246-2002. Curtis Decker, what about Charlotte's point that her daughter and others like her would be left without anything to do without programs like these?
Well, I certainly sympathize with her concerns, and we talk to parents all the time that have the very same concern. Remember, we went through this same experience when we were closing large congregate institutions where parents were very nervous about their children coming into the community and thought that they were safer in these big institutions, and we learned that those places became snake pits. Now we're sort of at the next iteration where we are now saying we want to have people work in an integrated fashion as well. But she makes some very good points. We have to make sure there's a transportation system available. We have to make sure the people are safe and they socialize. But she also said one size doesn't fit all, and yet that's exactly what we have right now. The majority of providers only use the sheltered sub-minimum wage method of involving people with disabilities of all levels. This will be a gradual period of time over the next several years as we try to convince people that there are alternative methods to bring folks into a much more integrated system. Remember, we passed the Americans with Disabilities Act 24 years ago with the concept of making sure that people with disabilities were in the mainstream of society. And we now have court cases that say segregation of people with disability is discrimination. And so that is sort of the impetus for challenging these sort of outmoded ways of doing things. That doesn't mean everyone's going to agree and may not work for everyone. But right now we have, as you said, 13,000 people in Pennsylvania, about 400,000 across the country. We know that the vast majority of those people could have a better experience.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with our guest, Hallie Stockton, a reporter for our content partner, Public Source. And also with us by phone from Washington is Curtis Decker, who is the executive director of the National Disability Rights Network. Let's go to Ben in North Hills. Ben, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Question is, regarding performance evaluations for these employees. So, typically, any staff would be reviewed, whether it's annually or biannually, and then, they would have that potential for getting raises and that sort of thing, depending on, whether or not that review is positive. Now, is this like a system where it's basically just a fixed rate, or would these employees, assuming that they're doing a good job, be able to, work their way up to a higher rate, whether it's the minimum wage or even beyond? And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ben. And so, Curtis, maybe let you take that one. Ben is saying, sure. Why stop at making it minimum wage? Can workers be given the incentive to go beyond that?
Well, yes, there are programs where certain companies get a preference with defense contractors. Some of those people make much more than the minimum wage, but they're still in a segregated setting. The law requires that 75% of the people be people with disabilities in order to get that preference. So we're interested in the segregation as much as the minimum wage. And then as the caller mentioned, this productivity assessment we think is extremely flawed. You have a supervisor standing over a person with disability, sometimes with a stopwatch, clocking them to see how many pieces they can do in a certain amount of time, and then use that as a basis for the productivity. I mean, we've certainly had situations where because the provider needs their best workers to fulfill the contracts, there's not much of an incentive to move that person out. And so you make sure that that person is always kept below the minimum wage and not referred out to competitive employment, because you've got that contract you've got to make good on. We're also concerned about the potential for exploitation. Why can't these companies that are contracting with a sheltered workshop bring those people into their own office to do the shredding or the other kinds of work? So therefore, they would also not only be having higher wages, but they may actually be interacting with non-disabled people. And what we think could be happening here is it's just a way of getting those people out of your life and getting cheaper labor because you contract with the shelter workshop. You know, there's not a lot of evidence of that yet, but we are in the process around the country looking at that to see if, in fact, this is just a way for certain companies to get cheaper labor and exploit people with disabilities.
And Hallie Stockton, as you reported this story, I've certainly been using the term quite often during the course of this show, the disabilities, which is really a very general term. In terms of clarifying what these disabilities are, talk about the people that you came across and the challenges they face.
Well, the majority of people in these programs in our state have intellectual disabilities, but this also covers a wide range of disabilities. Some people with multiple disabilities, possibly intellectual disability, Down syndrome, as well as developmental disabilities and physical disabilities. And even so far as there are some work programs that are designed for people who've had traumatic brain injury. And also to address Ben's question on that note, a lot of they do undergo evaluations, but they're not so much performance evaluations. They focus a lot on the person and how how they're progressing. So it's more of a kind of a welfare evaluation in a way. How is this person doing? Are they slowing down compared this quarter compared to last quarter? Is there anything they can do to step in or talk to the family?
412-246-2002. Let's go to Matt in Pittsburgh. Matt, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. My comment was sort of addressed, but I was just wondering, you know, the minimum wage itself is already somewhat of an arbitrary number. So why can't we include part of these additional services that the employees are getting as, you know, part of their overall compensation package when we calculate whether or not that they're being paid fairly?
Curtis, what about Matt's question?
Well, I think the caller is correct. I mean, the minimum wage is an arbitrary number, but it is sort of the standard by which, you know, the rest of the world is judged. And I think what's been interesting for us is that when in this debate about raising the minimum wage for all workers, I think people forgot or didn't even realize that there's this huge number of people with disabilities that are paid less than the minimum wage. So I think that is the standard. But we are interested in not only improving people's productivity so they can make more money, even if it is below the minimum wage, because as you've said several times, it is legal right now under federal law, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, companies that qualify can pay less than the minimum wage. We want people to move up that line and then eventually get into both at least minimum wage and then competitive employment.
Matt, thank you for the call and the question. Well, one thing I might ask here, Curtis, is could we have ideally perhaps a two-tiered system that depending on the qualifications of a person, depending on their particular disability, that you would have maybe one wage scale for some and then another for others that is more in line with what workers in the general society are paid? Curtis, what do you think?
I'm sorry.
Were you able to hear my last question?
I did not.
Okay. I'm wondering if there could be a two-tiered approach to this. Based on what people are suggesting here, that you could have one set of wages for people who for individuals with disabilities, and then maybe for those who are who qualify in some way as for lack of a better term, a higher functioning, that they would receive a different wage scale that's more in line with the minimum wage and what workers everywhere are paid.
Well, I would argue that, first of all, that's the system we have right now. And secondly, I just feel like it does put in the hands of the provider the power to judge whether someone is capable of making $2, $4, $6 an hour. What we're learning through a lot of demonstration programs, that if you know, find the talent within the individual and you don't have the expectation that these people can't do something, you can find many, many activities that they could excel in and then actually earn a minimum wage or even higher. As I said, there's certainly companies that pay more than minimum wage. As I said, the way the system is built now, it is you have to fit into that box, whether you can or not. How many of us actually apply for jobs we can't do? The rest of the world applies for jobs based on their qualifications and get hired if they're qualified. In this system, the person with a disability, and as people have said, may have lots of limitations, are pushed into a setting that they may not have any capability to do, but that's the model. And so we need to break that out and start to look at people raising expectations. When we go into these sheltered workshops, many of the providers then tell us what the person can't do. We want people to start thinking about what these people can do.
412-246-2002, the number to call to join the conversation with our guests. Hallie Stockton, a reporter for our content partner Public Source, who brought to light the story of disabled workers in Pennsylvania being paid legally sub-minimum wages, an average of $2.40 an hour. Also with us from Washington, Curtis Decker, Executive Director of the National Disability Rights Network. Let's go to Daryl in Canonsburg. Daryl, thanks for waiting. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good afternoon.
Hi, go ahead with your comment or question.
I volunteer at Life's Work of PA in downtown Pittsburgh, as well as I have a nephew who has Down syndrome, and I applaud these types of programs. He doesn't work at that yet. He's still a child, but I would hope that someday these programs will be around because I think they are very rewarding and very worthwhile for them, regardless of the wage.
Well, thank you for that input, Daryl, and it brings to mind a question, Curtis, about the concerns that social service providers have. They say the barriers to competitive employment are vast, and so the question becomes, are there enough jobs out there for disabled workers, especially with high unemployment in the general population taking up many of those low-skilled jobs?
Well, yes, certainly the bad economy does not help anyone, including people with disabilities. And so this, as I said, this is going to be a gradual shift away from an outmoded model. This is not about closing shelter workshops down tomorrow. It's trying to get providers to experiment. We also have, you know, a very robust vocational rehabilitation program. About $6 billion a year of federal money goes to states to work with people with disabilities, to train them and to help them get reintegrated into employment. They have pretty much abandoned the population in sheltered workshops. So we're also interested in getting vocational rehabilitation services, as I said earlier, assistive technology to try to improve the productivity levels. And we'll have to see whether the marketplace can, you know, assimilate these folks. But that is not a reason not to try to get them to be the highest level of performance and production. And if you talk to these people, they do think the money is important. They have, like most everybody, where they think they understand that what you make and how you're paid is, in this country, you know, how you are, your worth is judged. So while family members may be fine because there are, as the parent said, other kinds of surrounding benefits, Medicaid, supplemental security, you know, that round out the person's life, you know, we need to talk to the individual with disability and see what they want.
And Hallie Stockton, you're nodding in agreement here.
Yeah, just from going into to some of these work programs and meeting the workers, the money is very real to them. They talk about, they are able to cite, you know, exact cent for cent what they got on their last paycheck. And they talk about, you know, what they spend that money on and you know, whether it's bowling or movies or, you know, one man I spoke to in Westmoreland County, he lives in a group home and he wants his own apartment. And because he wants that independence that we all kind of seek at one point or another. And he earned $57 on his last biweekly paycheck. And you know, considering that, is that goal possible? I guess that's to be found out.
Let's go to Brian in Washington, Pennsylvania. Brian, thank you for joining us. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. My question is, my son has Down syndrome, and I actually have fears of him being a traditional manufacturing environment. But what hasn't been discussed is, what about the opportunities for retail type of shops manned by mostly disabled people, allowing them to interact with the community? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Brian, that's a great question. Curtis or Hallie?
Well, I would agree that the whole range of jobs should be available. And again, we are trying to convince people to move to a process of almost discovery, of trying to figure out what is the person's talent is and where they're going to fit in the best. And they may not be good in a manufacturing environment under high pressure with a lot of equipment or deadlines, whereas they might do very well in a retail environment. And we have people who do a variety of work in terms of landscaping and cleaning and working in the food service. So there's the whole range of jobs should be open to these folks, and they should be matched to those jobs with their abilities.
We have a tweet from Pamela who says, Arts for Autism and Steeltown collaborate on programs in Pittsburgh to train people with disabilities to work in the film industry. Well, we've had a lot of interesting input from people, from callers and folks tweeting us. We appreciate that, and we thank our guests for joining us as well, reporter Hallie Stockton, who has covered this story for our content partner, Public Source, and also joining us by phone from Washington, Curtis Decker, Executive Director of the National Disability Rights Network. Thank you both for being part of this conversation. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
Coming up, how investigators found an original 16th century portrait hidden underneath a Victorian-era overpainting. Faked, forgotten, and found works of art when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA.